This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and we call the show Main Street because our microphones are our virtual Main Street across North Dakota this time of day and adjacent places as well, like Minnesota, Montana, South Dakota, you know, those provinces to the north. And we've got the real Main Streets as well, where we greet our friends and acquaintances and talk about what's on our minds. And today, we're going to talk with Elisa Corin about a book she wrote about moving from a very big place to a much smaller place. It's called 100 Miles to Nowhere, and she joins me with Ashley Thornburg to talk about moving to a different place.
Elisa, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
100 Miles to Nowhere, an unlikely love story. You were in New York City.
New York City.
And you ended up in a very small town.
New York Mills,
well,
Minnesota.
You know, it's yes. New York City, New York Mills. It's
I did
almost
it for
the
name.
Same thing.
Yes. It actually has a Central Park. It's a very tiny Central Park in New York Mills, but there is a Central Park.
What brought you to New York Mills?
I was writing songs in New York City, and time and money were rare. And so I needed to find time and money to write songs about oddballs in history, which happened to be and still is my specialty. And I found this artist residency program at the Cultural Center in New York Mills, Minnesota. And on a whim, I applied, and then I got in. And then I had to look up Minnesota on the map. I am embarrassed to say I was that kind of New Yorker. I knew where many countries in the world were located, and I did not know where the states in my own country were.
So fly over Minnesota. You found it, though.
I did, and I will never make a mistake about where it is located on the map again.
You are a Yale University grad, and you went to the London School of Economics. Tell us about your background. What got you to New York?
I was born in New York City, in Queens, at the Long Island Jewish Hospital. My parents are actually Israeli, and they met on a blind date on a street corner in New York City in front of the Lord and Taylor. And I was born there and raised starting in New York City, and then my family moved around a lot because my father was an oil engineer kind of person. So we moved all over the place, including New Zealand. And then when I graduated high school, I wanted to go to Yale, and that's where I was very lucky and happy to end up. And everyone I knew, both from high school and from Yale, basically went to New York. And so it was inevitable. And I, of course, wanted to be there. That was where I hoped to be as a grown-up.
But you're a performer, songwriter, writer now with this book, 100 Miles to Nowhere. Where is the London School of Economics piece?
I took a left turn somewhere along the way. I have an undergraduate degree in history, and then I have a master's in international development. And I worked in that field for a little while. I even co-founded an international technology organization that brought technology to the developing world. And I was doing that for a couple years, and it was an amazing experience. But I realized I couldn't do both. I couldn't both be working for a nonprofit internationally and pursue my art. And somewhere along the way, I realized my heart was in creating. So I took that left turn. I started pursuing songwriting and more performing, and that's what brought me to applying to that artist residency program and soon arriving in central Minnesota where I had never been before.
And it inspired a book.
It did. It did. And this book is 344 pages of culture shock. My little elevator speech for people when I'm telling them about the book is, so I moved from New York City to New York Mills, and I dealt with a severe culture shock. I wrote about it in a book called 100 Miles to Nowhere. It has been recognized by a national independent book award called Next Generation Indie Book Award. It's the finalist. And it includes moonshine, cursing, and, oh, what was my third bit? Moonshine, cursing, and a pantsless New York City subway ride.
Is there any other kind?
Right, huh?
Well, that's after you strip for Stanley Tunick.
You
were one of the naked people in his Manhattan shot.
I was. I think that was news to my parents when they read this.
You have a lot of experience traveling internationally, but the focus of this book, you keep bringing up culture shock. Am I to believe here that you had more culture shock going from New York to Minnesota than New York to New Zealand?
You got it. And that was the irony. I mean, that was what propelled me to write this book. I had lived and worked all over the world. I had lived and worked in New Zealand, in England, in Israel, in Africa, in South America, in Europe. I mean, I'd been everywhere. And I really thought that I had culture shock. I was all over it. I mean, I would have no problem with it, especially moving to a place within my own country. And what became really clear to me is that living in an urban area anywhere in the world is a lot more similar than moving from an urban area in the United States to a rural area in the United States.
What were your first impressions of New York Mills?
First driving down the road, and it was raining, and the road was incredibly wide, and there were so few cars. And then there were so few buildings or amenities and stores. There was, to my eyes, it looked empty.
What's it look like now?
Full of people who know me and wave to me and activities and situations that I'm familiar with. And it's a very different perspective I have 10 years later.
Did you experience what we are so proud to call Minnesota nice?
I sure did. It's one of my favorite things actually about this place. And I know that the flip side of it people say is passive aggression.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I have to say that for me, it's much more about the warmth and welcomingness of people, and they're willing to give you a chance. And I think that that's a beautiful thing. And I've been so welcomed by my community, despite the fact that I'm incredibly different from so many of the people there.
Well, 100 Miles to Nowhere is about this culture shock. You go into that in some detail, but it's also a romantic story.
Yes, it is. The reason I ended up in Minnesota at all, or returning to Minnesota, I should say, after the artist residency, was that I ended up falling in love with someone, and of course with somewhere, as it turns out. But what happened was, when I was in New York City preparing to come to Minnesota, I'm very type A, and so I of course wanted to research everything down to the minutia. So I took out every single book on Minnesota in the New York City public library system. I had them piled up on my desk. I read everything I could. And the one thing that struck me was that if you're in Minnesota, you have to go canoe camping. And what they meant was the Boundary Waters, of course. But I was just thinking, I have to go canoe camping. So I tried to find a group trip, and I even used Craigslist, which led to some very interesting emails asking me out. I decided that was not the way to go. But there were no group trips available in May, and that should have taught me something about the weather here in the upper Midwest. But instead, I called the executive director of the New York Mills Regional Cultural Center, and she said, oh, I have the perfect guy for you. And little did I know, she actually meant, I have the perfect guy for you. But she set me up with a man named Chris Klein, who was going to lead a group camping trip. And he organized it. He got a whole bunch of people set up to go. And the week before it was scheduled, the 3-day, 2-night canoe camping trip, everyone else dropped out. And so he was a gentleman, and he said, we only have to go for the day. And I said, no! The guidebooks say camping. We have to stay overnight. So it ended up being a 3-day, 2-night blind date.
Except the actual date question doesn't come till page 58. I checked that out. And this camping trip took a long way before that.
It did.
Uh-huh.
It did.
So what caused the sparks to fly?
You know, I think, and as some people in some of my writing workshops tell me when they read descriptions of Chris, I am a terrible judge of character. And what happened was, he was just so nice, and I'd never dated nice men before. So I thought, well, you couldn't actually be someone I'd be attracted to. You're nice. And it took him a few weeks to convince me that actually, you know, nice guys are not all bad.
When did you know that the experience you were living was grist for a book?
It was less that I knew that this would make a good book, and more that I had to write a book, because that is how I, as a creative person, deal with difficulty. And so the first thing I did was I wrote songs that ended up being produced on this album called Concrete that I have here today. And when I was still not fully telling the story of this experience, I realized that I needed to switch mediums. And so I moved from songwriting to prose. Now, I was very naive as a prose writer. I thought, hey, I've written college papers. I know how to write. And it turned out that that was not true at all.
Well, let's get a sample of your songwriting, because this is from your CD, Concrete, and it's actually titled 100 Miles to Nowhere. that's just a sample from the CD Concrete, the title tune, again, 100 Miles to Nowhere. So it kind of relates to your book.
Absolutely. That's where the title for the book came from. And I even write about the writing of that song in the book.
At refrain, I need to keep on going. It's only moving that I feel at home.
The traveler's wanderlust.
Absolutely, Ashley. That's exactly what it was.
What kind of adjustments were the most difficult in your transition from megacity, New York City, to New York Mills, small town?
The lack of restaurants, the lack of ethnic cuisine, the lack of extremely delicious baked goods of all varieties at any time of day or night. But even more, the difference in pace and expectations and being an outsider coming in to a place where you have no real connections, and particularly in small towns, everyone knows everyone. Everyone knows where they came from, their extended family, the extended family's history, the skeletons in the closet. And on one, people would try to place me, and they couldn't. I mean, there was no peg. There's no hole for my peg. And on the upside, I've been incredibly welcomed, and people have now claimed me their outsider. I may be an outsider, but I'm their outsider. But in the beginning, it was really tough to be in a place alone without your friends, without your family, and to have to build a community from the ground up.
How much of your background, your life, has your husband Chris experienced, and did he have any kind of culture shock going along with that?
That's a great question. He's been at my side the whole way. He's been incredibly generous with his guidance and his love, and also with his life, because if you read the book, there's a lot about Chris in it. And he's a very friendly and outgoing person, but there are things in here that he would not choose to tell people, I imagine. But he acknowledges that that's just one of the prices you pay for being married to an artist, that your life is grist for the mill.
Was it ever a debate, we'll live in New York City, we'll live in New York Mills? Or was it always going to be New York Mills?
We had the conversation, but it was a pretty clear answer because, as most people know, New York City is incredibly expensive. And Chris had a family business that he had taken over. And either he would have to give up his entire life and come to New York and start over again, or I would. And it was a lot easier for me to do that as an artist.
Walk us through the process of actually writing the book. Were you writing things down as they were happening? Were you referencing journals or just your memory?
It was interesting. In the beginning, when I first had this idea, I decided I'd write a column for the local newspaper and that I would write down the interesting things that happened to me. So when I had this idea that I was going to put it together in a book, I just took all the columns and stuck them together and said, here, we've got a book. And then I learned very quickly that that does not a book make, and it doesn't create the journey or the arc that a reader really wants to have when they join you in a long-form storytelling experience. So one of my writing teachers helped me understand that. And at that point, I had to forego most of the work I had done for these columns that I thought I was recording these experiences that would then go in the book. And I had to go into memory. And people often ask me, how do you remember these things? I mean, how is it possible that you remember this? And the truth is, when you start writing, you write things you don't realize you even knew. I mean, the memories were coming up as I wrote, and I couldn't believe some of the things that came up that I had recalled. And the other part of it is there are some things that you have to go back to and say, well, I don't remember what I smelled here. What could that smell have been? Because it needs a smell. And so then you come up with something that is true but may not be accurate.
As I was paging through the book and I scanned a good bit of it, what struck me was a very entertaining story and, of course, a real story. I mean, it's your life, but it's kind of like a rom-com, too. Is there a movie there?
I've had readers say that there should be, which is really a treat to hear.
Well, should there be? I mean, is this something
I'd
you want
it.
To pitch?
Hey, if there is a director or producer out there who's interested in 100 Miles to Nowhere and Unlikely Love Story, call me, Elisa Karen. You can find me on the internet.
Well, you have a family now, don't you?
I do. I have a 3-year-old and a 1-year-old and 2 boys, and they keep me busy.
You're raising them in New York Mills.
We are raising them. And that is another wonderful thing about small town community is raising families there is it's very supported. I mean, the families support one another, and there's a lot of love for kids in these small towns. And I have to say that before I had kids, and it took us a long time to have them, we tried, and we were one of those couples that, you know, had to go through extra measures to make it happen. But during the time that we didn't have kids, I was a lot more isolated. And once I had kids, I became pulled into the community in a way I hadn't before. And that's a wonderful thing to experience as a parent. But on the other hand, if you're not a parent, it is tough.
So your life has changed from casserole to hot dish.
Absolutely.
And soda to pop and things like that.
But duck, duck, goose to duck, duck, gray duck.
You got it. You hit the three main ones.
Alisa Corinne is a performer, songwriter, and writer. And we're talking about 100 Miles to Nowhere. It's a brand new book, an unlikely love story. If you're in the Fargo-Moorhead area, she'll be at Zanbro's Variety this evening at 6:30 for a book talk and signing. And, of course, she's got that CD as well, Concrete, with that sort of title song, if you will.
You got it.
Alisa, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you guys so much.
Coming up on Main Street, a Plainsfolk essay from Tom Ezern.
Support for this program is provided by Great River Energy and its 320 employees who are partnering with North Dakota to help our country meet its growing demands for energy while utilizing new technologies for a cleaner environment.
Prairie Public is a listener-supported statewide radio network. We cover everywhere in North Dakota, from the Bakken to Bismarck, Wishick to West Fargo. But we wouldn't be able to bring you NPR News, news from the Prairie region, and all the great cultural and music programs you enjoy without the help of listeners like you. And so, we would like to send a special thank you out to our sustaining members, whose generous monthly contributions keep Prairie Public's radio stations and online streams humming along with quality programs and independent, fact-based journalism. Thank you, sustainers. We simply can't do this without you.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Tom Ezern teaches history at North Dakota State University. He's a distinguished professor of history. He also creates the Plainsfolk essays, and he reads them for us and you. And today, his essay is titled Heritage Trail.
Where a tired track curves into an open pasture, we call that a prairie trail. Where the section line is graded only occasionally and the traffic is mostly just farm machinery, that's a minimum maintenance road. Other section roads are graveled, and a step up from that, some county roads get the asphalt treatment. Then you have the red line highways, and for the smoothest ride, your green lines, your four-lane limited access highways. Where will you find the good stuff, the relics of local culture, the outcroppings of heritage, the tastes of country cuisine, the real things in real places? Well, it could be along any of these roads, although I confess a partiality for the ones less traveled. If you'd like to ride along or pick up tips for destinations of your own or share your own explorations, there is a place online for that. It's called Heritage Trails. For more than a decade now, I have directed a little research office at NDSU called the Center for Heritage Renewal. Its business is to identify heritage resources in the North Dakota countryside, help to preserve them for posterity and for use, and point out their value, both cultural and economic. We have a particular penchant to discover and talk about points of interest that are under the radar. Things that have been lost or neglected or just never before considered to be historic. Heritage Trails, a group operating on the social media platform of Facebook, takes the work of heritage renewal into the realm of crowdsourcing. Here, we of the Center and our friends who explore the Northern Plains in search of intriguing stuff talk about such things, sometimes brag about them. Go ahead. Search for the group in Facebook and join in the discussion. Some of what figures here is keyed to calendar. Right now, for instance, there's a lot of county fair activity, along with centennial and jubilee celebrations, the regular stuff of summer. We are easing into the season for threshing shows, and after that will come fall suppers, and so on through the yearly round. Every such event featured in Heritage Trails is an invitation to enter into a heritage community somewhere in our territory. The rest of the material discussed in the group is stuff to be found fixed on the ground. Heritage buildings, monuments, weird roadside monstrosities, forgotten works of art, purveyors of traditional craft and cuisine. Stuff that people go exploring for. Once a week in Heritage Trails, we have a feature called Where Are We Wednesday. I just posted this week's photo depicting a particular Badlands formation west of Marmoth called the Woman in Stone. I don't think anybody will guess this one, because I had a heck of a time finding it myself. There are some regular group participants, though, who like to turn the tables and post images that stump us, too. About 500 people are in the group, so what's the point? Well, first, there is solid value in this stuff. It books motel rooms in Wishick and brings diners to Dickinson. Second, it enriches our lives here on the Northern Plains. It gives us the sense we live in a storied land, a place that matters. And third, there is a feedback effect in communities across the region. We all need occasional bits of validation, positive feedback. When travelers come to town and ask about this or that attraction, it makes us feel better about our own particular places. We have stuff, things in our everyday lives that other people find fascinating. So come online for the discussion, but more important, get offline and explore. I always like to say, there's a story up every section road.
Coming up on Main Street, we'll have a report from Montana Public Radio about chronic pain patients and opioid prescriptions. Chef Rosie will drop by to talk about salmon that is curing and smoking it. And Ashley Thornburg and I will have our What's Happening calendar of events. Now, the news with Danielle.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. The State Health Department says it has so far received 9 letters of intent from people interested in submitting a proposal to become a registered compassion center for medical marijuana. Under state law, a compassion center is a medical marijuana grower or manufacturing facility or dispensary. The law says up to 2 manufacturers and 8 dispensaries can be established.
We do want to try to get dispensaries strategically located through every region of the state, because we want to have the best access possible in all parts of the state for patients or caregivers, so they don't have to drive so far to get their medical marijuana.
Kenan Bullinger is the Health Department's Director of the Division of Medical Marijuana. He says the next step will be for those interested to actually apply for the designation, but Bullinger says that process won't start until the rules are finalized.
We don't know when that's going to start. Originally, we had hoped we could get it out in early August, but I think it may be a little bit later than that, maybe mid-August or so, before we open up that application period for growers and dispensaries. And we're going to try to extend that out for about 7 weeks to give adequate time for those applications to be submitted to us.
Bullinger says an application has to be accompanied by a non-refundable application fee. He says the hope is to have medical marijuana available within 12 to 18 months of the time Governor Burgum signed the legislation. The Bismarck School District is the latest district in North Dakota to go to impasse. That means teachers and the school board were not able to reach a contract agreement. A state fact-finding commission will be called in to look at the two sides of the latest offers, and it will make a non-binding recommendation to the school board. Bismarck Education Association President Amber Ogstad says one of the big sticking points is over classroom safety. She says some students have become violent in the classrooms.
We have teachers who have been yelled at, screamed at by students. It's not uncommon for some teachers in their classrooms where if they have students who lash out and throw things or hit or kick, spit. I've had those things happen, you know, to me.
Ogstad says the Bismarck District has school safety policies in place, and some of the staff have gone to training for these issues, but she says the policies may not always work. Ogstad says teachers want a seat at the table when policies are being crafted.
Workplace safety is, it's part of working conditions, and we feel that working conditions, and then along with length of workday, those are things that that's your everyday working conditions. So we feel that those are items that should be able to be negotiated.
School safety has also been an issue in other school districts around the state. Augstead says the two sides are actually fairly close on the salary issue. No date has yet been set for the fact-finding commission to hear from both sides. And officials with the North Dakota Wheat Commission say the rain that was received in parts of western and central North Dakota this week may be a case of too little, too late.
They have caught some recent rains, and so we're starting to maybe get a little more green back in. But the problem with spring wheat is a lot of it's already made, that basically the growing season is wrapping up. So in terms of a benefit to the crop, we really don't see that.
Wheat Commission Marketing Director Jim Peterson says parts of the eastern third of the state have enough moisture to keep grains growing, but other regions, especially the southwest, are starting to cut the spring wheat crop for livestock feed. Peterson says growers who have been around a while, some historical comparisons can be made.
We were just looking at some numbers back in the 88 drought, you know, almost one-fourth of the spring wheat crop in North Dakota was not harvested. It was either didn't make enough bushels to even harvest, or it was rolled up into a hay bale. And, you know, we're not looking probably at the same level of abandonment this year, but certainly as a state as a whole, you know, 10% of our acres not being harvested is not out of the question.
Peterson says some elevator managers he has spoken with say the number of acres being harvested for hay could potentially rise to 30 to 50%. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. As the nation faces an epidemic of opioid drug abuse after a decade of aggressively prescribing narcotics, doctors are becoming more cautious about giving painkillers to chronic pain patients. It's changing some patients' ability to get treatment for what is considered compassionate care for chronic pain. Corin Cates Carney of Montana Public Radio reports.
Last spring, the Federal Centers for Disease Control and Prevention issued new opioid prescribing guidelines for doctors designed to address the national epidemic. In response, Butte Dr. Shauna Yates, the medical director of Southwest Montana Community Health Center, sent a letter to pain patients saying the clinic would no longer prescribe high doses of opioid painkillers.
I really do try to stress that I believe in their pain, that I understand where the concern that they're having is coming from.
But Yates says her clinic's new policies for the highly addictive drugs have caused a lot of patients to seek care elsewhere.
I've said it more often, even probably in the last 6 months than ever before. I'm not leaving them. If they decide to leave, they're leaving me.
The CDC guidelines encourage primary care doctors to become less dependent on opioid medications for treating chronic pain because of the drug's serious side effects, including addiction. The Butte Clinic started tightening its prescribing policies back when it had about 700 pain patients coming in for treatment, years before the CDC released its guidelines. It did things the CDC guidelines would eventually call for, like random drug tests, to make sure patients weren't abusing their medication or taking additional drugs. The clinic also required patients to only fill their prescriptions at one pharmacy.
Many of those patients left. There are many patients that just are not willing to follow those recommendations.
After the clinic put in additional rules for pain treatment and sent out a letter telling patients the clinic was adopting the federal guidelines, implementing a cap on how many pills it prescribed, about 400 patients left the clinic. Dr. Andrew Kolodny with the national advocacy group Physicians for Responsible Opioid Prescribing says lowering the limit on prescription painkillers is a good policy, and it'll help patients who are harmed by high doses.
For patients who are being required to taper down to on high doses, that's appropriate.
Kolodny is also the co-director of the Opioids Policy Research Collaborative at Brandeis University in Boston.
As doctors start to figure out that we shouldn't have been prescribing in this way, these patients are at risk of being cut off from a legal supply of opioids, and that's why we really do need a compassionate response for that population.
Kolodny says the main problem isn't people using opioids because it makes them feel good, snagging a few pills to get a quick high. The issue, he says, is the millions of Americans who were legally supplied and hooked on these drugs during an era of medicine where opioids were believed to be a good option to treat pain. Now, Kolodny says the most compassionate thing doctors can do is slowly and safely begin to take away the painkillers and start treating these patients for narcotic addiction. Because he and some doctors around Montana say regular use of opioids can actually make pain worse. But pain patients like Delaine Propp don't like being told they're abusing drugs.
We either do what they say we do or we get kicked to the curb.
Prop is a member of a pain patient support group in Great Falls. They got together because they feel they're being treated unfairly. There's about 100 members in the group's Facebook page. This spring, a couple dozen people showed up to the group's first meeting.
Let's see who we are. I'll start.
I did the physical therapy. We looked at the surgery option. We've done injections. And unfortunately, the only thing that kept me working and kept me going was the opiate medication. I think this whole thing that is going on with the CDC has scared even regular practitioners to even start people on some kind of pain regimen.
Now, I have no doubt there are patients who are telling you that they feel agonizing pain.
Dr. Andrew Kolodny.
And then they take their opioid and they're able to get out of bed and function and brush their teeth and have some type of life, and that without the opioid they wouldn't be able to get out of bed and they'd feel like they want to commit suicide. I can tell you that that's exactly how people feel who are heroin users, who are opioid addicted. Until you use your first dose of heroin in the morning, you're feeling agonizing pain and discomfort.
Kolodny says too few doctors who prescribe opioids also prescribe drugs that can help patients wean off the painkillers. If doctors want to help chronic pain patients move past opioids, he says more doctors need that addiction medication training. There are patients who say that once they got off opioids, it became easier to deal with their underlying pain issue. Some describe it like a fog being cleared. At the clinic where Dr. Shauna Yates works in Butte, patients are required to go to mental health specialists and encouraged to keep up a good diet and get enough sleep.
One of the biggest things that I think we have to do moving forward is we as a culture have to come up with better ways to treat pain. You know, the hardest part is to know that people are out there that are not getting great pain relief. And with a culture that is getting older and that are suffering, that's the part that bothers me. We can take stuff away and we can know that there is harm related to this, but I don't think the biggest challenge is taking these away. I think the bigger challenge is figuring out what are we going to do in place of it.
Yates says as she and other doctors learn more about how to treat pain, she wants patients to know she's not abandoning their care, even if that's exactly how some patients see it. I'm Corin Cates-Carney, Montana Public Radio.
Everyone is more than they seem in Capitol Shakespeare's production of As You Like It, July 19th through the 23rd on the state capitol grounds. In this gender-bending comedy, the banished Rosalind uses disguise to test Orlando's love, and courtiers and peasants revel in the transforming natural world of the forest. Shows of this 10th season production begin at 7 p.m. in the outdoor Prairie Amphitheater near the North Dakota Heritage Center.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and it's time to talk food with Chef Tim Rosendahl. He runs Rosie's Bistro in downtown Fargo, and Ashley Thornburg and I love talking about food with him.
And you can always talk food with him, too. If you have a question, you can send it to mainstreet@prairiepublic.org or find us on Facebook. We are Main Street at Prairie Public. And this week, Chef Rosie, you want to talk about lox. What's lox? Is it the same as salmon?
Well, you know, lox is a particular preparation of salmon, okay, but it's the confusion between lox and nova and gravid lox and kippered salmon and farm salmon and wild salmon and, you know, all of these different things. But at the end of the day, they're all salmon. Some are cured, some are smoked, some are wild caught, some are net caught, some are line caught. And then you've got all the salmons from all the different countries. But of course, what we see at the grocery store most of the time is a farm-raised salmon. So that's an aquaculture salmon. That's the mildest of all the salmons. The reason we like it so much in this part of the country is because it is very, very mild. The people that have caught salmon have been line fishing salmon for years in Ireland and Scotland and Norway and all around the world. They like the wild caught. It has much more flavor. It has much more color. It has much more vitamins in it. Those of us that really love salmon far prefer the wild caught.
Well, let's talk about the preparation. How do we make lox out of salmon?
Well, lox is a fillet of salmon, which is a boneless pin bone outside of salmon. Now, whether it has the skin on or off doesn't really matter. But most importantly, that salmon goes into a brine. And that brine is typically salt and sugar and dill and lemon and pepper. But it's never smoked. So you'll never find a lox that's been smoked. It's only cured. Now, when I say salt and sugar, a lot of recipes call for the same amount in when you're brining a salmon. But one thing to always remember when you brine, even though a fillet or a side of salmon is only somewhere between, say, an inch and maybe 3 inches thick if you've got a really big salmon, but you need to put weight on it. When you put it in that brining solution and you put that fresh dill and fresh lemon slices, and when I say pepper, it could be green peppercorns, pink peppercorns, Madagascar peppercorns, whichever you like. But then you need to put weight on it to get – you're basically forcing that marinade, that brine, into the meat because – how could I explain this? Very similar to when you cure something. You're actually cooking the fish with the lemon, with that salt and sugar, where that's actually changing the color of that salmon from opaque to translucent. It's making it so it has a different texture, a different feel, but now I can slice it. But that's what lox is. And now we can talk about the different types of lox here, too, because living in Miami for a lot of years, I come from a South Beach, which there are a lot of Jewish delicatessens, and boy, they know the difference between Nova and then and lox. It's a big difference. People like one or the other, and Nova, the big thing is it's traditionally it was from Nova Scotia. That's where it came from, but that's not as important anymore is the fact that it's cured and smoked. So one is cured and one is cured and smoked. Do people break that rule, or are you going to have we going to have people that call in and say, well, my grocery store, it's, yes, we've done a lot of interchanging between those two. And when you make lox, just like when you go to the sushi bar and you have salmon, if you get the toro of salmon, that's the belly of the salmon. And that would be the fattiest part of the salmon, and that would be what they call the penultimate of this, of making lox or nova, is that little strip of belly fat on the bottom of the fish because it's high in fat.
Does that mean it has the most omegas? Omega-3s, sixes,
absolutely,
or
the most omega-3s, for okay. Sure, yes.
Now, there are different ways of smoking fish. There's cold smoking and hot smoking, so which is which in this particular case?
Well, you know, oh boy, I have favorites. Almost all the fish that I've ever smoked, I far prefer colder smoked, which is between 130 and 140 degrees. But the most important thing is when you start smoking, you know, there's the danger zone of all food, and that's 40 to 140. That's what they call the danger zone because that's when bacteria grows. That's why the health department says you keep your food below 40 or over 140. So what hot smoking is over 140. I just said 130, 140, but it's a real fine line there. And you can cold smoke as long as you've brined that fish first. And cold smoking can be, I've cold smoked many thousands of pounds in a refrigerator.
And how do you do that?
Well,
you wreck your refrigerator.
Yes. You take it very simply, actually. You take an old refrigerator, one that you're not using anymore, and you make sure that the shelves are stainless or clean or whatever. And you drill a hole in the side of it, and you take your smoker next door and you plug it in the hole.
So
and
this
start.
Is not a normal at-home process.
No, cold smoke, you know, cold smoking at home is very – I don't recommend it to a lot of people because they always end up right smack in the middle of the danger zone and not below 40 degrees.
So – we've got our lox. They're great all by themselves. Any other ideas for, you know, serving, recipes, whatever?
Well, you know, it's amazing because of all the different parts of the world that I've had Nova and I've had lox, so often it's served with lemon, it's served with capers, it's served with red onions,
I'm
it's, served,
good there. Yeah.
It's served with toast points
nothing
or crackers or bagels, but that is become, you know, that is the way you eat it. Now, that's not to say that we can't make a wonderful quiche out of Nova or lox. Or that's not to say that we can't make a sauté, use that same cured salmon and sauté it and serve it as an entree for dinner with your favorite dill sauce or champagne sauce or any sauce like that. But then you get, in Mexico, for instance, they'll do a, call it Mexican lox, and they'll do a chili powder and lime. So they'll substitute lime for lemon.
Oh.
They'll substitute chili powder for dill, and we're just transitioning it over to that Spanish-Mexican feel. In Greece, they would use lemon and oregano, very common. And then, of course, my favorite Indian spice is za'atar, which is
so good.
It's so good. Yes, you know, I've learned to. You can put that on bread. You can put it on. But now this is the first time I realized on lox it would be just amazing. Well, I think it's good on everything.
I love that bagel with lots of cream cheese, the tomato, the capers, the red onions.
It's like too big for your mouth.
It's about 1,000 calories at least, but it is really good.
Well, that only the cream cheese part of that whole communication was the calories part.
Well, the bagel is pretty rich in calories.
Yeah, as long as if you load it up with. You know, I never forget the first time I had a bagel in New York City, and they truly handed it back to me, and the two bagel halves were 1.5 inches apart. I mean, not just a smear of cream cheese, but like, you know, that little tub of Philadelphia cream cheese you buy, the little 4 ounce, you could just set that right on the bagel. I think I scraped off 3 ounces. I ended up eating it later, but it's good.
Now, there's one more thing we can do with this salmon, right? We can pickle it.
Yeah, when you pickle salmon, it's, you know, there's lots of we can pickle, so it's a refrigerated pickled salmon, or a lot of the salmon, if you want to keep it in the cellar, just like all of your pickled beets and pickled asparagus, then, you, of course, you have to go through the whole canning process or the whole pickling process, which means you have to boil the jars first. And you have to make sure everything is sanitary, because you don't know if that pickled salmon you're going to make is going to be something that you're going to eat in 5 years from now down at the lake cabin, or something that you're going to eat next week. When it comes to seafood, I far prefer the refrigerated method, because I would rather pickle it, eat it, and put it in the refrigerator, and eat it over the next 2 weeks. It'll be fine. As soon as you start putting fish away for months or years, I just have to be there when the pickling process happens, because I want to see how sanitary everything was. Because seafood, as we know, is one of the most when it comes to HACCP regulations, it's one of the most dangerous things we have in the kitchen.
Well, bon appetit. Enjoy the lox. If you have a question for Chef Rosie,
send it to mainstreet@prairiepublic.org, or find us on Facebook, Main Street at Prairie Public.
And next on Main Street, what's happening?
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
Well, that is the question we ask every Thursday. Ashley Thornburg and I look at what's going on. We check our What's Happening calendar of events.
And we check that out by looking at different tourism-related websites across the state, different newspapers. A lot of people email them to us directly. The one that I want to start out with this week is the launch party for Be More Colorful. If you listen to Main Street tomorrow, you're going to hear all about this. This is a virtual reality company that is putting together a Kickstarter campaign to do virtual reality tours of North Dakota. It's kind of an effort to get more people to come and visit the state. The launch party for the event is from 5 to 9 p.m. in Fargo at the Front Street Tap Room. It's free. It's open to the public. This is a bar, though. You do need to be 21 to enter.
Well, this is another Fargo event, but this is a great idea. I hope other cities pick this up. It's a city department series. It starts Tuesday in Fargo at the main library at 7 in the evening. If you've ever wondered about how the city of Fargo works, what the different departments are for, how to get involved, then you'll love this four-part series featuring guest speakers from several city of Fargo departments. The department leaders will share aspects of their area, hold a brief question and answer opportunity. All ages are welcome, and light refreshments will be served. The session coming up Tuesday, that is July 25th at 7 o'clock in the main library in downtown Fargo, will be about the forestry department, and it's free.
This Sunday, there is a Sunday history program, the 23rd, in Abercrombie at the Fort Abercrombie State Historic Site. There's going to be a researcher presenting on the topic, the Davies Wagon Train from Fort Abercrombie to Helena, Montana. This research looks at a recent trip to Helena following the famous wagon trail routes, and you can learn all about that. And this is at 2 p.m. Sunday, the 23rd, in Abercrombie at the Fort Abercrombie State Historic Site. It is free.
The 33rd annual Badlands Star Party is Friday and Saturday in Medora at Theodore Roosevelt National Park's North Unit. Telescopes will be set up at the Oxbow Outlook. That's 14 miles from the park entrance. Constellation tours will be offered as soon as the stars are visible. That's approximately 11 o'clock Central Time. In addition, the sun can be viewed through a solar telescope at the North Unit Contact Station pullout from 2 to 3 p.m. Central Daylight Time on Saturday. Nights in the North Dakota Badlands can be cool. Rain is a possibility, so a jacket or sweater is recommended. The North Dakota Badlands Star Party is presented by the Northern Sky Astronomical Society of Grand Forks. It's an amateur astronomy club associated with the University of North Dakota. Again, those hours are 11 o'clock in the evening on Friday and 2 in the afternoon on Saturday. It is free to take it in.
A performance of As You Like It, the great Shakespeare production here. This is Thursday through Saturday, the 20th through the 23rd in Bismarck at the Prairie Amphitheater. This is a comedy of mistaken identity, and it is being performed again through the 23rd. Shows are beginning at 7 p.m. at the outdoor Prairie Amphitheater south of the North Dakota Heritage Center. Lawn chairs and a blanket, something you should bring along to this performance. It gets going at 7 p.m. Performances are free to the public, but free will donations are going to be used to offset the cost of the production of As You Like It.
How about Pulitzer's in pubs? It's Sunday in Grand Forks at Rhombus Guys Brewing Company. It'll be at 4 in the afternoon. The script discussion of Pulitzer Prize-winning plays continues with Bruce Norris's Clyburn Park. Clyburn Park picks up where A Raisin in the Sun by Lorraine Hansberry left off, but of course it's decades later. I've seen the show. It's a lot of fun and very thought-provoking. Join in for a free discussion facilitated by Dr. Darren Kerr at Rhombus Brewery. That's in the Opera House on South 3rd Street in Grand Forks, sponsored by the North Dakota Humanities Council. Again, it's Sunday afternoon at 4 o'clock.
Family Fun Night 2017. This is in Grand Forks at University Park, Tuesday, July 25th. This is the Park District inviting you to an evening of chalk art. There's going to be a parade, an ice cream social, face painting, family games, and a free showing of the movie Moana. This is from 6 to 9 p.m. on Tuesday, the 25th in Grand Forks at University Park, and it is free.
Youth-led history tours Tuesday in Bismarck at the former Governor's Mansion State Historic Site. Local youths will lead tours while portraying children of governors living at the mansion from various eras. Children being portrayed include the son of Governor Frank White, the daughter of Governor William Langer, better known as Wild Bill, and more. Tours will focus on activities, music, and games of the era and stories of guests during the time. Children will also share what their school days involved, how they celebrated holidays, what service staff prepared for dinners, and more. It's free. It's at the former Governor's Mansion State Historic Site Tuesday in Bismarck.
All right, I'm going for my event of the week, and it is a National Day of the Cowboy this Saturday. There is going to be a celebration of that in Medora at the North Dakota Cowboy Hall of Fame. You can learn about North Dakota's famous cowboys, and you can learn about ranching and rodeo history, Native American history, and enjoy cowboy and Western music and cowboy poetry as well. Gets going 9 a.m. Mountain Time, and it is free.
The MSUM Summer Cinema Series, Monday in Moorhead on the MSUM campus in the Weld Hall Auditorium. Minnesota State University's Summer Cinema Series enters its 41st season with four evenings of silent films. This is the next to the last one coming up. It's a collaborative project of the School of Media Arts and Design and the Red River Chapter of the American Theater Organ Society. World War I is commemorated with two films on July 24th. The Bond, a short propaganda film, precedes the feature film Shoulder Arms, a war comedy starring Charlie Chaplin as a boot camp private who wants to be a hero. It's 7:30 Monday evening at Weld Hall at MSU Moorhead. It costs $4, and that's what's happening.
So, did we go too fast? Or do you just want to find out more about the events you just heard? Well, you can. Just go to prairiepublic.org and click on the events tab, and there too you can submit your own events. And who knows, maybe it'll be featured on a future What's Happening here on Prairie Public.
Support is provided by Drs. Kirk Coyer and Phil Sondrel of Urgent Med, providing personalized walk-in medical care for all ages 7 days a week in South Fargo. Urgent Med, where urgent care doesn't feel like urgent care.
This is Dakota Datebook for July 20th. On this date in 1911, three masked men held up a Northern Pacific train between Tower City and Buffalo. Armed with revolvers, they collected $500 from the passengers and went to the locomotive. They ordered the engineer to stop the train so they could get off, but he refused. One of the robbers shot the engineer, but he still refused. After being shot again, the engineer finally complied and brought the train to a halt. The robbers jumped off and ran a short distance to a waiting getaway car. When news of the robbery reached U.S. Marshal James Shea in Bismarck, he quickly organized a posse, which arrived at the train where it remained stopped. Detectives collected evidence and interviewed the passengers and the engineer, who was not badly injured. A description of the men was telegraphed across the state. Other law enforcement agencies also formed posses and joined in the search. The Hope Pioneer expressed concern because the robbers appeared to be professionals, possibly responsible for previous robberies, and if not caught, would probably strike again. With such a large search quickly put into action, confidence was high that the men would be caught in a short time. That confidence was not misplaced. The newspaper added a last-minute heading to the article. All three robbers had been captured in Melrose, Minnesota. Another notable spate of robberies took place in 1983, when a man robbed six banks in Nelson County, even robbing one of them twice. When he robbed another bank in Aneta, residents quickly responded, jumping into their cars and pickups to give chase. By the time the robber was captured 65 miles away, over 100 locals were in pursuit. The bank teller was glad it was the sheriff who caught the man, saying, "It's a good thing none of the farmers caught him, because they'd have torn him to pieces." North Dakota banks are still robbed on occasion. In 2015, an oil worker from California was arrested for robbing two banks in Stanley. But train robberies seem to be a thing of the past. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Carol Butcher. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from the North Dakota Humanities Council.
Friday on Main Street, we'll talk with Matt Shosey about his company, Be More Colorful. It's a Fargo-based firm that wants to create virtual reality experiences that feature North Dakota. News director Dave Thompson will drop by to talk about the week's big stories, as he does every Friday. And Matt Olean will review War for the Planet of the Apes. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Friday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.